Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. Good morning to you. Good morning to the frightened of all around the country, because things are getting a little weird again, it seems to me. Riley, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing all right, man. Yeah? I wasn't on a double-decker bus in Times Square yesterday, and I wasn't in Penn Station yesterday, and I wasn't in some of the places that were turned upside down yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, things are, they're getting a little tense, and I don't know what's right and what's wrong in this kind of situation in terms of, you know, what do we do to safeguard our subways, our buses, and this kind of stuff? Is it necessary? We'll talk about that in just a second. Lance Armstrong won his 7th Tour de France and then got up on the podium and said, "That's it, folks. That's all. Yeah. I did it. What else am I going to do?" You know what I love about this guy? And I don't understand the sport. I'm reading about it, and
that's for you.
Why don't we get the phone, Chris? That's the first time that's ever happened. Did it happen once before on our show?
Yeah, it did.
Is it for me? Tell her I'll call her back if it's my wife. I told her not to use this line. So Lance Armstrong says he did it for his kids.
Yeah.
And I think that's a sort of a beautiful sentiment. He quoted, I'll quote Lance. Okay, this is getting silly.
It's Lance.
Did I say something wrong? All right. So he says, Lance Armstrong says, is anything important? Let me know. Lance Armstrong says, quote, I wanted to ride into Paris in yellow for them, for their last image of their father as a sportsman to be that of a champion, end quote. Now, see, this is the interesting thing about this sport, Riley, because I'm not a sports guy, is that this is really a solitary sport in a lot of ways.
It is a solitary sport, for sure. And remember something, Mark. This is an incredible thing this man did.
Yep.
He had testicular cancer, which had started to spread to his brain.
Yeah.
Now, they brought the cancer into remission. Had he simply competed in the Tour de France, it would have been
an amazing
feat. Never mind, not just competing, but winning 7 times. Now, to give you an idea, I crunched a few numbers this morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know what the total length of the Tour de France is, if my math is right?
It's like 89 miles or something?
2,242 miles.
Wait, for all of them, you're saying?
For all of the stages, the 21 stages of the Tour de France.
In just one Tour de France?
Yes!
Come on.
2,242 miles. That's 3,600 kilometers.
That's crazy. If I ride my bike 3 miles and run a few miles, I'm like, wow, I did something amazing.
I know. If I do 25, I'm like, oh, I am king.
25 miles?
Yeah.
You've ridden 25 miles straight?
Absolutely.
Oh, you mean on the bike?
On the bike, yeah.
Oh, recently?
No.
Yeah.
Not recently.
Well, no, I think it's an amazing testament, because this is a guy that's an inspiration to a lot of people. This is a guy that's an inspiration to people who have cancer. You know, he's provided a lot of hope for people. He becomes a sort of an icon, a symbol, something for them to aspire to, something that gives them hope in a lot of ways. He's reinvigorated, if it was even invigorated to begin with, the sport of cycling, which is not a big American sport, certainly. But now, you know, because of Lance Armstrong, you know, a lot of kids want to get involved in it. And also, I think that he's done an amazing thing in transcending a certain amount of scandal in his life. He's been accused of steroid use. He had a wife. He
never caught.
Yeah, I never caught, and he might not ever been guilty. You know, when somebody has enough natural talent and enough natural will and focus that he wins this many, it becomes suspect. But maybe he is just a guy that is incredibly gifted and incredibly has an amazing amount of perseverance. And, of course, those kind of people, they're going to be like, there's got to be something wrong with that guy.
This guy,
you know, he's got to be up to something. He's too good.
Well, you know what people are now talking about.
What?
Lance Armstrong for public office, maybe for Congress.
What do they got to ruin something for? You know, what do they got to ruin something for?
Ruin a good thing. Turn him into a crass politician.
Exactly. Turn him into a spineless bastard who'll do anything to forward his own career. I mean, you know, this guy, I am impressed, and I'm happy he's retiring. He deserves a break. But I think also what I was saying before, to transcend scandal, to be married, to have this sort of like this cancer thing, to be this beacon of light, to divorce his wife and then run off with a rock star, you got to love him for that too. And to stand by it, I appreciate it. Congratulations, Lance Armstrong. Here's something for you. If you don't think global warming is real, folks, let's take a look at some of these numbers.
Whoa.
Man, it was hot here, but my brother lives in Phoenix, and the poor guy, he was on the phone with me. I said, how's it going? He goes, I can't talk to him. The phone's hot. You can't even go outside in Phoenix. Apparently, if you're outside too long, your hair starts to burn. Look at this. Las Vegas reached 117 degrees Tuesday. That's tying a record set in 1942. Now, okay, when you have the record, then it doesn't really prove the global warming thing. So let's find some other numbers that will fit our frame here, Riley. Reno, Nevada set a record for that city's most consecutive days of 100-degree heat in a row. 10. Dig that.
Yeah, and Tucson had 39 days in a row where the high temperature was better than 100.
My God.
That's over a month.
Could you imagine that? I mean, I've been to Phoenix, you know. My brother lives there. I had family there. You go there, and it's 110. I'll tell you, you go outside, and you have that first moment, like, wow, this is really hot.
Hot, yeah.
And then you're sort of like, it's kind of cool. And then you're like, I'm going to pass out. You know, you're like,
get me out of here.
You can have that water? No, I'm serious, man. I need that water. You say that a lot in Phoenix. Dude, did you bring water? I need water. Is there any water? It's hot. Denver tied its record for the hottest day of all time. 105 degrees on Wednesday. Grand Junction, Colorado set a heat record Thursday with 106 degrees. I tell you, man, if it breaks 100 in New York City with the humidity here, I get, you know, it's weird with humidity. Even if it's not, even if the temperature is not high, you feel the weight of it. It's like you're in a pressure cooker, and you get home and you're achy and your head hurts. It's disgusting. You're nauseous.
It feels like you're carrying something over your head for, you know, like a hood or something.
Oh, yeah.
for an extended period of time. And remember, I don't know whether any of this is directly tied to the whole issue of global warming, but it would seem to me that these kind of temperatures for these sorts of stretches are so unusual that maybe something's up here.
Yeah, I would definitely say that something's up. It has been getting hotter, but you know, I'm one of these people. It's weird. My wife is walking around all day. It's too hot. It's too hot. There's something about me. I don't mind the heat. I like it. I like being knocked out. I'm telling you, when you don't do drugs anymore and you got very few outlets chemically to knock yourself out, if God's going to do it, if there is a God, if it's global warming and I'm getting high, fine. Is that wrong? Is that selfish?
No, the part that's selfish is if there is a God.
Oh, there you go. So, so this weekend, yeah, aside from a lot of, you know, activity freaking out, like the double-decker bus, let me just tell you briefly what I did. I did some comedy. A lot of people are coming down, Riley, and they want me to say hi to you. A lot of people are coming down to the comedy club to see what I look like.
Really?
Yeah, they walk up to me like, you're funny, but, wow, I thought you looked different. You know, I'm like, oh, is this all right? Am I okay? You know, and they're like, say hi to Riley. They love the show. A lot more people are coming down. It's very
That's
nice.
That's fantastic. Tell them to come to CBGB's a week from Friday.
This Friday the 5th, we're going to be
Friday
at CBGB's.
The 5th. August 5th.
What else did I do? I had a pretty productive weekend. I actually made baked macaroni and cheese, like the real
really?
Way. You know, yeah, I know how to do it, man. I'm gonna have to bring a tray in because it's one of those things where I'm looking at recipes because we talked to that guy Schwartz on Friday. The guy who wrote the
big cookbook. Arthur Schwartz.
Yeah. So I'm looking through his book, which is a beautiful book, and there's a recipe in there for baked macaroni and cheese. And that's one of those things where, like, God, could I make that? Because if I could make that, I'd have everything figured out. You know, you know what I mean?
What kind of cheese has he got in it?
Well, I didn't do his recipe. They're mostly for cheddar. Because I didn't really love his recipe. It was an Automat recipe from the 30s or 40s. And it was but it didn't appeal to me, so I go through a couple other recipes. But this one, man, I made it for my wife with no wheat because she's got the wheat thing, the wheat allergy, so I used brown rice macaroni. But that's all right. It tastes the same. Who cares? It's all cheese. Cheddar cheese with the buttered breadcrumbs on top, baked. Dude, I mean, once you make that, we're both giggling. We're like, oh, no. You know, she, by the end of the day, she's like, I think I ate too much. I have a stomachache. And we went through a whole tray of this stuff. It was unbelievable. Okay, so that was exciting. Very productive.
Comedy and macaroni and cheese.
Hey, what else can you ask for? So, but let's talk about what you were talking about at the beginning of the show, which is that a squad of cops armed climb onto a Gray Lines tourist bus, you know, tell everyone to get off, leave their bags so they can be searched, and put a few guys, five guys,
Asian, in handcuffs.
Asian cats with English accents, handcuffed on the ground, kneeling, then they go, oh, sorry, I guess
wrong
it
guy.
Wasn't a problem. Yeah, this was in New York City. And the thing about this is that, you know, we've got this news. People want cameras all of a sudden. Both Democrats, Republicans are talking about nationwide surveillances surveillance cameras at train stations and everywhere that people congregate. And now you've got this. And this is the scary thing about this, Riley, is the tip-off was not an investigation. They weren't looking for anything. Some guy who works at the bus line, not even a driver, said, hey, these guys, they look shifty to me.
Yeah.
And then, bam, they're on the ground with handcuffs. That cannot be the way this is done.
And, I mean, this was with a large phalanx of police. You know, kids got terrified. They were thrown off the buses. They evacuated a McDonald's that was near where this incident took place.
This can't be the way this happens.
It was a mess. But you know what? Yesterday, we had a conversation, Mark, and I think maybe we should extend this later on today, about exactly what is the purpose of all of the surveillance? What's the purpose of the cameras? Is it to prevent crime? Is it to try and stop terrorism? Or is it to help identify terrorists after they strike?
Right, exactly. Is it a deterrent, or is it something that will help in the investigation? It's the same with the searches. We're going to have a conversation about that when we come back here in a second, because they are going to be searching bags.
Yep.
They are telling us they're going to be searching bags, and there are other different reasons for them telling us. It's not just to alert us. It's also to protect their own butts. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Edition. Good morning. It's Monday, people.
You know, whoever with his phone system can themselves in the mouth and eat their own waste. You know, that's what I say. So leave me alone. I'm trying to get a good take and replay it back on my touch tone pad. So can I play and get a good recording so I can hear how it sounds? I got an inconsistent mental disposition.
Next message.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Twenty-one past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's Monday. We're talking about fear, I guess, is what we're talking about. What's going on? What are the repercussions of fear? Institutionalized surveillance and searches. You know, are they the right thing? Is it a deterrent? Is it not a deterrent? I'll tell you. You know, after this London thing, and after this Egypt thing, and after I did some reading about the supposed agenda of the new Al Qaeda, it's all very scary, and it's hard to parse out what the truth is. I mean, links have been uncovered between the two teams of bombers that have wreaked havoc and death on Britain. The bombs were similar, of all things. This is interesting to me, Riley. Through intelligence and investigation, British officials found out that a few of the bombers involved in both the bombing and the botched bombing intended a whitewater rafting trip.
Oh, yeah, up in and somewhere in the north of the country.
You wouldn't think that would be the getaways of Al-Qaeda would be a whitewater rafting trip. You know what I mean? And what a bizarre bit of business that is. And also, in a frightening development, police are investigating an East African link. This is what scares me a lot. Two addresses found in raids late last week have linked individuals to the bombers and also linked those individuals to family connections in Somalia and Ethiopia, which are, of course, both, you know, extremely desperate, war-torn countries, full of anger and starvation. And this is really just a petri dish for you know, terrorist activities or at least recruiting. But what it implies to me is that in collusion with this, a report from the International Crisis Group came out that says there's a new Al-Qaeda cell in Mogadishu, and what they're thinking is that there's a leader of this Al-Qaeda cell there. This is officials in England, a young Somali militant who had been trained in Afghanistan, is actually, they've got a dispatch center where they send people out to look for talent and infiltrate smaller groups of Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. Not unbeknown to the people who are members of that cell necessarily, but they are connected. So they're reaching out to, I think, these Al-Qaeda terrorist cells that are building themselves.
Well, that's the thing that people are really have to start paying attention to. What you have here is a largely faceless, ruthless enemy. The people that were involved in the London bombings are people that we are finding out about after the fact. They were not known to intelligence before the fact.
Yeah, exactly. And the scary thing about all this is that with so many unanswered questions, with a very vague description of what behavior is for a terrorist, you know, the British police, who aren't accustomed to shooting people or carrying guns for that matter, you know, shot the hell out of a guy.
Yeah.
You know, they shot a guy on Friday at the Stockwell subway station. He was identified as a Brazilian citizen. Witnesses said he was wearing a heavy padded coat when these plainclothes police guys chased him down, chased him into a subway car, pinned him to the ground, and shot him five times in the head in front of people. Five times in the head. Apparently, that's what they're supposed to do, because if they think the guy's wearing a bomb, if you shoot him in the body, it might blow the bomb up. But it turns out this guy was guilty of nothing other than being an electrician, wearing the wrong kind of clothing, carrying a bag of tools.
Yeah, I mean, this has the potential to become the British version of the Amadou Diallo shooting, which so rocked New York back in 1999, where, again, an immigrant his movements were misinterpreted, and the next thing you know, in the Diallo case, the cop shot at him 41 times. In this case, again, an immigrant to Britain, his moves were apparently misinterpreted by the police. Now, the thing is, he apparently left the same house that they had been surveilling, Mark. That was what first put them on. It was a guy dressed up in a heavy coat during a warm spell in London.
Right.
And, you know, the guy was dressed up in such a way and left the house and made them think that he was somehow connected to the terrorist plot. And, of course, they found out tragically later he wasn't.
Yeah, after they shot him five times in the head. Now, this is a problem. This is a problem with this type of profiling, with this type of surveillance. And it's scary because here in New York, you know, now you've got them. They're going to institute subway searches. They're going to put more surveillance cameras at stations. And the obvious concerns are, you know, racial profiling, discomfort with having personal items examined publicly, like medicines, toys, sensitive personal items, hygiene products. There's a violent suspicion is a problem. And of course, getting shot in the head five times if you're innocent is a problem. And, you know, the British officials have not apologized for this. They expressed regret. They said, unfortunately, it might happen again. This is crazy. Who are the terrorists? Is it the state or is it the terrorists? And is it right or is it wrong? Because there's part of me, Riley, as I said on Friday, where it's like knowing that the cops are there, knowing that I'm not doing anything wrong, makes me feel a little better in terms of I think that searching can be a reasonable deterrent to people that might be getting on the train with a bomb. Has it happened here? No. Am I? If I wear a jacket that's the wrong size or too heavy in the summer, am I putting my life at risk? Maybe. It's less at risk because I'm not, I am not of ethnic origin.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, those people, the people who are most afraid of racial profiling, no matter what they put into place, it's going to be an issue.
It is going to be an issue. And the question of whether or not the police know what they're doing as they go about this business is going to be one that is going to resound in London, in New York, and wherever else they step up security like this.
What do you think? 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. If you're a New Yorker, if you're anywhere, where do you stand on this? Is this good or bad? Is it frightening? Is it unconstitutional? We'll talk about that in a second. Stay with us. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition, 27 past the hour. It's Monday.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Mann here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. It's Monday. If you recognize that is the theme song to 6 Feet Under, which apparently, I'm sorry to say, I missed last night. I haven't been keeping up with it. My wife enjoys the show. She's got some friends that write on that show, and I like the first season, but then I just don't know where you get the time to watch all this crap. I don't know. I'm so busy just keeping up with doing my job here. I have very little time, but apparently we were on the radio in the car of Claire, on her way somewhere. And what part of our show was on there, Chris? You have it?
This is a corporatized Christian cult situation where it's about personal empowerment, which is part of the Republican agenda, the neocon cult agenda.
There you go. That was me in her car on 6 Feet Under. And Chris, you say it's a very pivotal episode.
Yes, that was a great episode. And
okay.
If you ever watch that show, you should watch the repeat of the show. Listen for Morning Sedition on Claire's Radio and watch the entire episode because it changes the entire season.
We are taking calls at 866-303-2270. We're talking about surveillance. We're talking about searching. We're talking about a climate of fear that makes people easily led. Also, a climate of fear of personal personal safety in light of train bombings. I'm reading an article over the weekend by this professor who has done a large survey of suicide bombers' personalities and intents, and also he began to discuss something that I didn't know about, which was some Norwegian intelligence from a couple of years ago that says that Al-Qaeda's agenda at this point, the guy's name is Robert Pape, Al-Qaeda's strategy at this point is really to continually hit our allies, or the U.S.'s allies, in efforts to get them to detach from the U.S. in their global imperialistic mode of occupying countries that are, you know, either Muslim countries or not. It seems that most of the suicide bombings are not done primarily because of, you know, extreme fanatic jihadism, but they are done out of nationalism. Rocco, streaming in New Paltz, what do you got for us? What's on your mind, buddy?
Well,
hey, Rocco.
Wake up, sheeple. This is all, like you said, it's cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
The cause is we have troops in their holy land.
Mm-hmm.
The effect is they bomb us.
Mm-hmm.
If we take our troops out of their holy lands, they will stop bombing us.
Do you think so?
I know so.
Okay.
I'm sure of it. The other thing is like, and when did this whole thing start to happen with these whole people, with the English bombings? When Bush's ratings went way down.
Right.
Again.
Right. Well, they apparently, you know, because of the English bombings, I mean, this was really a part of a synchronized effort on behalf of them to do exactly what you're saying, Rocco, which is get our allies out of Iraq and put the message out there that they're not going to take this occupation anymore. Thanks for your call, man.
You're welcome.
Yeah, this seems to be the ongoing strategy, and it seems to, I don't know if it's a bluff or not in the sense of why they have not attacked the United States again, or whether or not there are active cells within this country. You know, we all assume the worst, or we all assume conspiracy, but the truth of the matter is, they haven't. And if this is because of a strategy put in place by Al-Qaeda, and it's just ominous, that's more frightening to me than the fact that they might not have, you know, any active cells here.
Well, you know, we have been told for a long time that these insurgents were doing this sort of thing because they, quote, hated our freedom, unquote. Obviously, what we are seeing now, both inside Iraq and some of the bombings that are going on, whether it's in Madrid, London, whatever, we are seeing people who want to affect a policy change. That's what they're looking for. In terms of the British bombings, what's the end game? The end game is to get the British out of Iraq, to isolate the United States as the only player that is still left inside Iraq, and then they perhaps will begin the process of trying to formulate a change in American public policy.
So the basic point is here is that if policy doesn't change, or if something, some sort of diplomacy isn't engaged, that what will happen is this just becomes this war. It's a cold war of surveillance and deterrence, and just the world we live in is constantly filled with fear and the possibility of being blown up. I mean, the MTA here in this city is installing more security cameras to videotape public areas. Only 76 of the city's 468 subway stations are now safeguarded by cameras that videotape riot. And safeguarded is not my word, actually. Safeguarded by cameras that videotape riders and also are monitored by officials. Another 200 stations have cameras that are monitored by officials but do not tape. Now, random bag searches will be expanded to bus stations, light rail, and air trains today. The NYPD hinted that the subway checks might not last forever. This is what happens in the city, is that after something goes down, they do this for a little while, and then it kind of drifts away. It's a publicity momentum, but it's costing the city $2 million a day in overtime charges on behalf of the police, which I'm not saying they don't deserve, but it is costing the city $2 million a day just to search this bag thing, and there are other issues at hand, constitutional issues.
Well, I mean, you have a gentleman by the name of Captain Eric Adams, who's an old friend of mine, by the way, who runs an organization called 100 Blacks and Law Enforcement Who Care. They're based here in New York. Eric Adams has climbed the ladder within the New York City Police Department, and he has worries about the racial profiling that he believes will happen as a result of these searches, as a natural consequence of these searches. He doesn't believe that the NYPD can do this truly at random.
Well, that's one of the stipulations. I read a little bit. One of our guests from last week, David DeCole, law professor down at Georgetown University, was quoted in a piece I was reading. He said, a judge evaluating a legal challenge, we look at three factors: whether the searches are truly random or use standardized criteria, whether riders were given advance their consent to the searches, and the degree of intrusiveness Apparently, according to a two-page directive sent to all police commanders last Thursday, the searches were begun, quote, to increase deterrence and detection of potential terrorist activity and to give greater protection to the mass transit riding public. Now, what's happened now is to avert lawsuits and legal challenges based on the constitutionality of the searches in relation to the Fourth Amendment's prohibition against, quote, unreasonable search. Describe the searches as random. They should rely on frequency that is not subject to officers' discretion. Now, this is something that your friend Riley says is impossible, and I might agree with that.
Yeah, he has a very big problem. This is Captain Eric Adams. With the idea that the NYPD can do this truly at random. Now, when you mentioned that there would not be a whole lot of leeway, what would happen under this plan, and what is happening, is that a supervisor at a particular scene determines how many people, depending on the numbers that are coming to the station.
Sure.
Yeah. How many, 1 out of 5, 1 out of 20, 1 out of 100, how many people would actually be stopped and searched? Now, we have yet to see, except, of course, in the situation with the double-decker bus yesterday, we have yet to see how this works out in practical terms. Now, some people may argue that the detention of these five guys that they stopped was a small price to pay for New Yorkers' security.
Well, let's paint that picture again for people. Yesterday, on a tip from a guy who works at the Gray Line bus, saying that five people on a double-decker tour bus look suspicious. This is just a guy.
Yes.
This is not an investigation. This is not intelligence. It's not anything. A guy calls, bam, squad of cops are on the bus. They evacuate the bus at gunpoint, leave the bags on the bus to get searched, put five guys who were Asian on their knees, on the ground, in cuffs, because they had English accents. They were Asian, and they got a tip from a guy who worked at the bus saying, you know, they were quickly released. But what that kind of ruined their day, if not their whole vacation. Is that what we need to accept? Is that the way this is supposed to be done?
Well, that is going to be the central question here, you know, because they, you know, New York has said for the last I don't know how long, you know, if you see something, say something. So that's what this guy was doing.
Oh, but that, you know, they got to get, I just don't know why they substantiated that tip. Is it because of the timing? And then Penn Station is evacuated because some lunatic puts his bag on the counter, says there's a bomb in it. Turns out he's got a history of drug use and lunacy. And, you know, in the whole place, they shut down the entire Penn Station.
Penn Station for an hour.
Daniel,
yes.
Daniel, listening in San Diego, what's on your mind, buddy?
Hey, Daniel.
And I am rolling in my almost grave listening to you guys.
Yeah.
Although I do love you.
Yeah.
I am completely conservative, and I will say this. George Bush makes me roll in my soon grave.
I'm not sure exactly what that metaphor means.
Yeah, what is a soon grave?
He is not a conservative at all.
No, he's a totalitarian, strange neocon. Yes.
I don't know what's going on.
Well, what's on your mind about this issue, Daniel?
Well, number one, I did hear you say something back, and this is not the original comment that I wanted to call on, but I'm going to say black mark. Is that a negative thing for you to hear right now?
No.
Okay. You said something about the black group against something. No.
100 blacks in law enforcement, who cares? There's nothing against
exactly.
In the title.
Why do we have 100 blacks? Let me ask you this, Mark. If you heard 100 whites in law enforcement, who care? Would you be upset?
Not if I knew what their mission was, no. If their mission was to fight racism within the police department, no.
Okay,
man. So
that's all.
This has been very productive, Daniel. I appreciate your call. The thing is, I wish you would have stayed on topic. So now it's all of a sudden it's like let's deconstruct politically correct language because you guys. All right, we didn't need that. I wish you would have stayed on topic because I thought you had something to talk about. What is happening here and what is frightening to me is that there's part of me that surrenders to fear, Riley, and I'm trying not to, and I don't want to live in a police state. I don't want to be frightened of the police and of potential, you know, attackers. I don't know how to do this properly. There's a question about surveillance that we didn't get to that I'd like to get to, is that surveillance in and of itself, video surveillance, is not really a deterrent. It is something that has helped in investigations.
After the fact, yes.
After the fact, and in London as well. They do not have the technology in place to take video images in the present and lock them on with rap sheets or main. What am I trying to say? With the identification of
There's no instantaneous identification of a terrorist through a picture. That they can't do.
They're trying. There has not. They're trying to have that technology. And who knows if that's going to be faulty? But they, you know, a lot of people believe that this stuff just doesn't work. There are the ACLU doesn't believe that this stuff is effective, and also there's the issue of. Do we do this at the cost of our Constitution because we're frightened? Because this will pass, and if things are put into play now that can't be retracted so easily, who the hell knows how this will be used? That's the big question, and that's the big conflict for me. It's a big conflict for a lot of people. I don't want to be searched, but as you said, Riley, we get used to it. Is that what we want to get used to? And who knows if in England, if you're wearing the wrong thing, you could catch a few slugs. It doesn't matter whether this guy, some people reports say he was running away. I don't care if he was running. They shot him when they had him pinned on the ground. It almost sounded like an execution to me.
Yeah. And well, I mean, they were obviously afraid that the clothing he was wearing, that he was going to blow himself up. That was a probably legitimate fear. But then the question, do you take a man's life? Who pays when the state takes a human life like this?
I think we got a little more momentum on this. We've got a couple more calls on the line here. It's 866-303-2270. I'd like to hear some more angles on this. Some people think that it's all a big sham, that it's all being, you know, manipulated and maneuvered by Karl Rove and his puppet universe, right? That, you know, he can just make at the wave of his hand terrorist explosions happen all around the planet to protect himself and to keep the American public frightened. I don't know. Is he capable of that? Is he guilty of perjury? We will talk about later, but we'll take your calls in a second. 47 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning. It's Monday.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Fifty-one past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's Monday. Good morning. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
We're taking your calls at 866-303-2270. We're talking about random searches in light of the London bombings here in New York City. And some New Jersey rails are going to be searching airport trains, I guess Amtrak as well. We've already had some events following, the killing of a man in the subway in London, 5 times, shot in the head because he was wearing too big a jacket. And he was coming out of the same building that the cops were watching. We don't want this stuff to start happening everywhere here. I mean, yesterday on a tip from a bus line employee, cops got onto a bus with their guns drawn, had everyone get off, had 5 Asian guys with English accents get on the ground on their knees, had them cuffed, and let him go because it was wrong. I mean, we can't have this unleash, this chaos. We're getting a lot of opinions from people who live here in the city. We got a call here from Jerry in Pennsylvania. Jerry, listening to XM, what's on your mind? What about that?
Hey, Jerry.
Good morning, Mark. I totally disagree with the bag searches at both the bus terminals and the train stations because I truly feel it's a violation of our civil liberties. One of our founding statesmen said that those who are not willing to defend liberty and security deserve neither.
That's right.
I truly believe that these searches are ineffective. If anything, they just drive who's they're planning to do such a thing further underground.
Okay, so you're saying there's no that because of the will of these guys, if they're really willing to blow themselves up, this is not going to act as a deterrent at all.
100% correct.
Okay, thanks for your call. Let's talk about some of these cases, Jerry. I appreciate it. At least 3 United States Supreme Court cases will probably influence any judge in assessing these searches. In 1979, in Delaware versus Proust, the court held that random traffic stops left to the discretion of police officers unconstitutional.
Unconstitutional, yes.
1990, Michigan versus Sitz, the court upheld the legality of sobriety checkpoints in which a consistent proportion of drivers was stopped. The court ruled that such roadblocks were permitted as a way to prevent drunken drivers.
Now, the important part of that ruling, Mark, was consistent.
Yeah.
In other words, they had a formula, and they stuck to the formula.
That's right. The court has set limits on those roadblocks. However, in 2000, in Indianapolis versus Edmond, it struck down the use of traffic checkpoints that stopped drivers so that trained dogs could sniff the vehicles for narcotics. unlike checkpoints to make sure the drivers were sober or had valid licenses and registrations. The court said roadblocks for general law enforcement were unconstitutional. There's the hinge right there.
Yeah, it is a very big hinge, as a matter of fact.
Exactly what this guy is talking about. Where does it stop? What does it do? Is it, does it violate the search and seizure stuff, the illegal search and seizure stuff that we're protected from in the Fourth Amendment? Then the way that they're buttressing themselves is, as I said before, is that they've made some choices around the language of how they're presenting this to the people. As we said, they describe the searches as random. This is Mayor Bloomberg and Police Commissioner Kelly. The supervisor thing is going to guarantee that they're not racially profiling, and they're going to search on judging by the number of volume at a station. The extensive steps have been taken to notify the public about the searches. This is true. That's another way to protect themselves from lawsuits.
Well, see, here is the unspoken part of all this. Some people may be willing to abide this kind of search, even if it's unconstitutional, because it has the side effect of reducing crime generally. Both searches and cameras may have the effect of deterring potential criminals that have nothing to do with terrorism.
That's right, but there's also that slippery slope, because that's initially what these things were used for, and the whole idea of the mythic terrorism that is supposedly going to happen here, whether it will or not. I mean, it's certainly happening elsewhere, and it's real. This is not some sort of joke. But all we have now here, outside of 9/11, which was awful, is fear. Here is the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today, folks. Here we go for the week. One, before tomorrow's launch, flood NASA with emails demanding they build a hybrid shuttle. Two, criticize Lance Armstrong's acceptance speech after winning the Tour de France for not blasting Karl Rove even once. Three, protest plans to expand daylight savings time as discriminatory toward vampire Americans. Four, alert Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee that John Roberts' horoscope, as well as several throws of the I Ching, are all decidedly negative. If bad vibes aren't grounds for the filibuster, what is, people? Five, to conserve energy and avoid brownouts, encourage people to turn their sets off during Bill O'Reilly's show.
Ooh.
Six, today's phrase just dropping into conversation. Checking your backpack is just the beginning, man. Then it's your car, your desk at work. Then it's your apartment or your house. Then you're in a camp with a tattoo on your wrist choosing which child you want to keep. Wake up, sheeple. The so-called war against terror is a chance to wipe out the real problem. Your civil rights. Whoa. You're behind enemy lines for the next 3 years.
So Lord have mercy.
We're going to do it. We're going to do it in the next hour, my friends. We're going to talk about the perjury charge. It looks like Special Prosecutor Fitzgerald has got some teeth, and it looks like that they might have an actual charge of perjury that will stick on Karl Rove and Scooter Libby.
Scooter. How do you trust somebody whose name is Scooter?
This is very exciting stuff. This is very exciting stuff about the missing 12 hours, the Alberto Gonzalez connection.
Andy Card.
If I've made you interested at all, you're going to have to wait it out because, when I was going over this stuff yesterday, I was like, oh, my God, this might really happen. I don't know what, but one of them's going to take a hit. It's 57 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's Monday. Good morning, people.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Blah, 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 blah. It's 6 past the hour, geniuses. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
We're getting into it. Dude, let me tell you something, Riley. I went to a bris yesterday. A bris.
Ooh.
It was only the second one I'd ever been to. I guess the third, including mine, but I don't have any recollection of that one. But man, it's heavy stuff.
Yeah, I've heard.
I went with my wife. It's my buddy Ari, his baby. It's like a party, but it's a heavy party. You know what I mean? They bring a guy in, the moil, the special guy, the rabbi that does the cutting. And he talks about it. He gave a little presentation. There was singing and dancing. He says, this has been going on for 4,000 years. This is what connects us to Abraham. And there's some sort of secret, weird little ritual that, the father's supposed to take the remaining foreskin foreskin, plant it under a tree, and then when that kid grows up and is about to get married, you go over to the tree, and something else happens.
But what happens to what the foreskin is supposed
no,
to
be? No, I know. You take a branch from the tree, and you use it in the chuppah of the wedding.
Oh, okay.
You
all
did
right.
That. See, the circuit, it's a full circle thing. But, man, I'll tell you, when you know you couldn't really see what was going on because the grandfather was standing in front of the table, intentionally so, and there were no pictures allowed because the kid, you know, that's not a memory you want
to
share.
The kid screamed like crazy, though,
but
right?
Here's what happens, right? So, you know, they give the kid a dab of wine, starting a life of alcoholism. And then, I mean, what could be more the beginning of alcoholism than, like, we're going to cut a piece of your thing off, but just to numb it, we're going to give you some alcohol. You know what I mean? How is that not going to stick in that guy's unconscious craw? But I don't know. That's not true. It's just a dab. But anyways, so they do it, and the kid, they're not a peep out of him, but I'm looking at the mother's face, Marie, who's looking down at it going, oh, my God, maybe this wasn't a good idea. I mean, I'm sure she wasn't saying that, but there was definitely concern on her face. And then the kid doesn't cry at all. Not a peep.
Not a peep.
Apparently the nerves, it's not that big a deal. So after it, though, thing is, like 5 minutes later, like fine, and the guy who did it, he's like, wow, he's really upset. I'm like, wouldn't you be upset? It's a delayed reaction, for God's sakes. He's just been circumcised. Give him a few minutes to process. You know, anyways, it was a heavy way to spend an afternoon, but there was food after, good bread.
How long did it take the actual surgery?
Seemed like an eternity, my friend.
I can imagine.
I mean, it's supposed to be fast, you know, and it was just like snip, snip, and that's all you heard. I'm like, are we done here? Is this done? Thank God, because my mother said that my grandfather brought in this old guy to do mine. My grandfather did, this old rabbi. My mother said, took forever. And I'm like, what? She's like, I didn't know if there was something wrong. I'm like, great, great. Let me just put that on the list of things that went wrong that might explain my personality. So let's get on with this. Lance Armstrong won the 7th Tour de France in an amazing feat of athleticism, sportsmanship, everything else. The guy said he did it for his kids. He said he wanted them to have that image of him coming into Paris wearing the yellow jersey because they wanted him to see their last image of their father as a sportsman to be that of a champion, which I thought was beautiful. This is a guy that overcome incredible personal obstacles, cancer, divorce, accusations of steroid use. 7 in a row. He's a real inspiration to a lot of people, and he reinvented a sport that I'm still not interested in, but apparently a lot of people are.
Well, you know, it's funny about the steroid thing, because he was tested over and over and over again simply because people didn't believe that someone could recover from cancer and win a race as grueling as the Tour de France. So he's been tested, and tested, always come up clean. But then, you know, with the revelations around Balco, where the entire thing was about masking the steroid use in the first place, people said, well, he was able to cover up the fact and you know, he was able to actually get a false negative.
Yeah.
You know, but as it turns out, no one can say that Lance Armstrong ever used any steroids.
No, that's right. He might not have. You know, they're always going to say, that guy's too good. You know, let's take him down. There's always going to be that momentum. On Saturday, 88 people were killed and 120 injured in attacks that used more than a half a ton of explosives in three different detonations at the Egyptian Red Sea resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. Mind-blowing, man. They are using the size of the explosives that are going on. We got a report in today that a car bomb and a rock, 500 pounds of explosives.
Yeah.
These are not small bombs. And this is an insurgency that is building momentum, that is getting more devious, that is replenishing itself as each one of them falls. The U.S. military, on an anonymous tip from an Army intelligence officer said, you know, we can't stop them. We can't stop them. As soon as we kill one, they come back.
Yeah, and I mean, there were apparently a pretty large number of Britons that were staying at this particular place, the Gazala Gardens Hotel.
9,000, which makes you suspicious, doesn't it, Riley?
Yeah.
Maybe they're more organized. They're more organized than we think.
Well, and I mean, it brings up the question, as do most of these attacks, wherever they're taking place, how does the United States, or anyone else for that matter, fight this kind of totally ruthless and seemingly impossible to quantify insurgency? I mean, people join, it seems like, every day. They are recruiting suicide bombers in numbers so fast and so large that intelligence services can't even keep up with them.
Yeah, the U.S. Marine was killed over the weekend. Their attacks are leveling off at about 65 a day. the Army official said. 65 a day, that's leveling off. That's been pretty steady. 65 a day. Now, let's not forget why we're in this war, why we went there. I don't even know why I use the collective we sometimes. We were put in this situation on a bunch of evidence that has proven to be lies, okay? And I just said that like Al Franken, I'm sorry. But they've been proven to be lies. One of the lies being the yellow cake uranium story out of Niger, which was disproved by Joe Wilson, and Joe Wilson paid the price in the sense that his wife, Valerie Plame, was outed, and it's as a CIA agent, and this is still picking up momentum here. There are all kinds of new additions to this unfolding conspiracy. There definitely was, I believe, a conspiracy among the White House staff, certainly among, you know, Dick Cheney's staff and George Bush's staff, and that means that Dick Cheney and George Bush are also responsible for this covert operation to literally, you know, make Joe Wilson pay the price for going against and going against their desire to go to war by showing that they were lying. The WMD thing turned out to be a lie. The yellow cake uranium turned out to be a lie. And people do care about this. This is what I love. There are people dying in Iraq. 1,775 American soldiers dead in Iraq as of yesterday. For what? For lies and for the entrepreneurial violent adventure of the neocon death cult's secret plan that it goes back to 1995. These guys don't care. They don't even care if they get charged for perjury. They've made a fortune. They've made a fortune, and they've guaranteed military contractors a tremendous amount of our money for years to come, and they don't care. But this is, they are the cause of this war. This is, they, it was a design that they did. They based it on lies, and now I think somebody, at least the American public, can see what they're dealing with and how this administration is full of cowards and immoral people that are unwilling to take responsibility for their actions around this Rove case. I think we're going to see that.
Well, what we're also seeing, Mark, is the fact that the American government now cannot pull itself out of Iraq. And maybe the neocons had it in their heads that no matter what happens in the next election in 08, that what they have started here will not be able to be, you know, no one argues that an American president should sit and negotiate with the insurgents. Nobody says that.
Right.
So save that. How do you get out of this?
Yeah, well, that's certainly an answered question. But let's talk about also how do we get into it. And we're going to talk about Karl Rove, the Alberto Gonzalez connection. Stay with us. It's 14 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Nineteen past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey,
thanks for coming down on Friday. Was that just last week, man? Friday,
yeah,
at
man.
T Lounge. Good times. Thanks for coming down. Everyone showed up. It was pretty exciting. It was fun. We had a nice show. We're not going to do a live one this Friday, but the Friday after, on the 5th, we'll be at CBGB's here in Manhattan, so gear up for that.
Yeah.
Also, Air America Radio has launched a petition demanding that President Bush fire Karl Rove. Go to airamericaradio.com/Rove. To sign the petition. And you can also podcast Morning Sedition. You can take Morning Sedition with you on your MP3 player if you go to morningsedition.com to learn more. Apparently, we're losing traction in terms of, in light of porn. Apparently porn has now hit the iPod world. It's iPorn and it's happening. We're going to talk about that later. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily we've got the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator to help us out with that. Here we go. Let's feed it some headlines from the Washington Post. Modest goals set for North Korea nuclear attack. Nuclear talks. Woo. Modest goals set for North Korea nuclear talks. Feed that in there. Modest goals set for North Korea nuclear talks. Translation. We'll only discuss annihilation of Europe, North America. Yeah, see? So it's modest goals. Oh, phew. Wow. From Associated Press, poll. Americans say World War III likely. Poll. Americans say World War III likely. Translation, North Korea begins nuclear talks. All right. From the Associated Press, inventor of the TV dinner dies. Inventor of TV dinner dies Translation, inventor of TV dinner dies, remains to be placed in four separate compartments.
Ooh.
We did that because, you know, Mort Mortensen's on vacation with Milf Cardinal Milfington and the other one.
They're all gone?
everybody, they're all on vacation. Riley, you going to be okay?
Man, I'm upset.
I bet you
are. I'm really upset.
All right, let's get into this. I'll take your mind off it, man. So, Alberto Gonzalez, as White House counsel, was the first one to be notified of the Justice Department had opened an investigation of the outing of Valerie Plame at the request of the CIA, at the request of George Tenet. That was at 8:30 p.m. on September 29th, 2003, that Alberto Gonzalez was alerted to this. Now, if you're just tuning in, we're talking about new revelations in the Roe perjury case, which is now a Roe perjury case, I believe. It took 12 hours from the time that Gonzalez got that phone call to notify the White House staff that it must, quote, preserve all materials, quote, end quote, relevant to the investigation. Here's the catch, though. He did tell Andrew Card, who is an evil bastard. He told Andrew Card, White House Chief of Staff, about the investigation. All right. And it was pretty amazing. He admitted this on Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer, who was stunned. And his next guest was Joe Biden, and Schieffer said, quote, doesn't this open up a whole new can of worms, end quote. I would say so, Bob. Now, here we got 12 hours, Riley.
Yeah.
Andrew Card, who I can't trust. I can't even look at that guy without getting angry, without getting hateful, without realizing there's no reason to believe that guy for anything. Republican Party stooge for years.
Mm-hmm.
He's the only guy that knows that they're under investigation. You don't think that little bastard scrambled around, shredding stuff, burning stuff, getting this plan into place that just how are we going to deal with this? What do we do? How do we deflect this?
Yeah, and it looks like they had at least 12 hours to do what they had to do.
Hey, yeah, go ahead.
Well, and now you also have, on the other side, questions about testimony. Now, first of all, this is, I guess, the first time Gonzalez has admitted publicly that he did, in fact, testify before the Fitzgerald grand jury.
Okay. And Schumer said, Charles Schumer, who I'm liking more and more each day, he's becoming a real little pit bull, said, quote, any good prosecutor knows that any delay could give a culprit time to destroy the evidence, end quote.
Absolutely. And now there's a question about exactly what kinds of conversations went on between Scooter Libby and Tim Russert from Meet the Press. He's become part of the story now because Tim Russert has said that he did not know of Valerie Plame or that she worked at the CIA and did not provide that information to Libby. Yet Libby is saying, along with, Carl Rove,
yeah,
that they learned of Plame's identity through reporters. So now the question is, through what reporters?
Yeah, this is all breaking down, you know, and it's clear that there were other officials involved that haven't been named outside of Rove and Libby. Libby, it's clear to me from the indications from this whole revelation about Alberto Gonzalez and this missing 12 hours, and on top of that, the memo at the core of this conspiracy to outplame and punish Wilson. The memo at the core of the conspiracy is essentially, it was a memo dated June 10th, 2003. It was labeled top secret at the top of the first page. A paragraph referring to Valerie Wilson, who is Valerie Plame, at the CIA, had the letter SNF in front of it. Secret, no foreign, that means. And it means that the info is secret and no foreign national can see it. Now, as we've reported before, the memo was taken on a plane by Colin Powell just days after, if not the day after, the Joe Wilson op-ed discrediting the yellow cake lie. Fitzgerald has questioned White House aides about who saw it. It can be assumed that he is trying to find out whether any of the aides violated the 1982 Intelligence Identities Protection Act, which makes it a felony to disclose the identity of a covert CIA employee. It can be assumed, I believe, Riley, now, that this was the agenda of Rove, Libby, and several unnamed officials that created the covert agenda of teaching Wilson a lesson and in frightening anyone else who might question the false premises, the lies that sent America to die in Iraq. And this is something we were saying before. Espionage, conspiracy, I think they all knew from this memo. And I think that's what needs to be proved to hang these perjury charges on these bastards.
Well, yeah, because in order to believe what they're saying, you have to believe that all of these people were ignorant. Libby, Rove, Card, all of them, Gonzalez, all of them were totally ignorant about an intelligence matter and found out about that intelligence matter, not from someone inside government, but from journalists, whether it's Matt Cooper, Judith Miller, Robert Novak, Tim Russert, whoever. That's absurd.
They were doing what they do. They were sending out the basic message of chaos. So everyone's scrambling around going, wait a minute, how the hell could reporters have known this first? The whole premise is ridiculous. You know what I mean? That you've got officials in the White House staff saying we learned it from them. It's crap. It doesn't make any sense.
Of course it doesn't make any sense, but it creates that whole aura of plausible deniability that these guys think is going to get them off the hook.
Plausible deniability and confusion. Now, we got a guest coming up in a second that's going to, what you're seeing with this story is that because of the persistence of the journalist community, for once, and, we've been doing this for 2 weeks, the persistence to keep this in the public's eye, to make it relevant and important to the American people, which it should be, that you have a president who is lying, obfuscating, stonewalling, saying that, hey, I can't make any statements until the investigation is done. That dishonest, that unable to reel in his own administration. This is all real stuff. And now you've got a narrative unfolding that shows that there was a conspiracy. But we had a fight for this frame. We had a fight to keep this frame in the forefront of the American consciousness, in light of a Supreme Court nominee, in light of a lot of other things. And it is sticking, and it should stick, and it should be important to the American people. Matt Bai, our guest from the New York Times, is going to talk to us about, we're going to explore how Democrats need to put their goals into specific concrete words in order to go toe-to-toe with the Republican spin machine. A frame needs to have a story. A story needs to have some core value to it. It needs to be built in something. It needs to have roots.
Yep.
And we're going to talk to Matt about that in just a second. It's 27 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. It's Monday. Good morning, people.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hours. Mark Maron here with Mark Verratti.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. What's going on, people? Welcome, WSMB, 1350 AM in New Orleans, Louisiana. Welcome aboard. Happy to be there. I'm very excited to be in New Orleans. It's very exciting for me to know that my voice might be coming out on the dashboard of a car stereo with maybe a little Jesus right there on the dashboard. I don't know why I would say that about New Orleans as opposed to any other place down south or even, right here in New York. But I'm just welcome. Good morning, New Orleans. Very excited to be there. Now, on the phone, my friends, it's no secret that the Republican Party machine is the master of language manipulation. For example, tax relief, pro-life, partial birth abortion. With the Democrats' victory over the first Bush Social Security plan and now the fight to keep Karl Rove in the front pages of the nation's newspapers, are Democrats finally learning to fight using similar techniques, and is it enough? We are pleased to welcome a contributing writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. He is working on a book on the future of the Democratic Party. It's going to be published in 2007. He spent a lot of time thinking about language and the way it can be used to persuade voters. Matt Bai, welcome to Morning Sedition. How you holding up out there in Chicago? It's hot, huh?
It's hot and it's early.
All right. Hey, Matt.
I'm doing all right.
Man, a heat index of 116, man.
Well, it's only 116 outdoors. Inside the AFL-CIO convention, it's really about 130.
Oh, wow. So, look, we have talked to George Lakoff on our show before. We've had some experience in talking about framing. George Lakoff, why don't you explain to us who he is and how he has become sort of like the guru of framing language?
George Lakoff is a Berkeley professor who hates to be called a guru because that's a frame. And what Lakoff is, first of all, I should say, is a really distinguished academic. Decades of really important academic work that you and I probably hadn't heard of, but that actually is. Has made him a very distinguished linguist around the world. He's an expert in linguistics, and his basic theory is that we all think in frames, which is really in metaphors, that people unconsciously, without realizing it, compare what they see in the world to metaphors that are hardwired into their brains.
Deep in there.
Deep in their brains. You can't surgically mess with these things.
Well, that's why, you know, the issue is that you can't just change people's mind by telling them something different. You have to engage them in a story that will resonate to their core.
Right, and then not only a story, but Lakoff argues it has to be the story, that the metaphors we all use. So that we see nation as a family, and we see political leaders as parents, and if you don't activate the right parental metaphor, then people can't accept what you're trying to tell them on a very basic level, because this is what really interests, I think, a lot of Democrats. The notion is you can be right, you can have all the facts, and people will reject them. It's a very comforting theory for a lot of Democrats who believe that they've articulated the right positions and haven't won elections.
Well, it's interesting, because Lakoff released a book, Don't Think of an Elephant, which is a small book, which became very popular with Democrats and liberals, because they were going to go home, and they were going to start, you know, reframing at home, and you know, integrating new frames into their own language. And it really needs to be a broader effort than that. It always frustrated me, because Lakoff's ideas, even when you isolate them, are you know, they're difficult, and you can use them as a personal experiment, but this thing has to be initiated on a party level and on a cultural level in a massive way.
Right. I mean, if you want to look at the Republicans as sort of the purveyors of linguistic manipulation, then you have to accept a couple of, I think, tough realities. One is that didn't happen overnight. We're talking about many, many years of a sustained linguistic approach in which Republicans systematically sought to change the lexicon of American politics. You also have to accept that it came with a lot of different kinds of proposals that had not been in the public arena, that were new ideas, that were energized by a very cohesive and maybe simplistic, but a very passionate worldview and philosophy for where they wanted to take the country. Both of those things, I think, are very relevant to any discussion of how language is going to affect politics.
Well, then we do, you know, as Democrats, and they have social issues that are important. We've attempted to sort of reframe some ideas ourselves. You know, you can talk about, you know, reproductive freedom. You could talk about, what's the one for tort reform?
Denying victims' rights.
You know, I mean, there's ways to look at this, but it seems that when you are fueled by a narrow-minded agenda and a conservative agenda, the options are far fewer.
Well, I'm not sure I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I think it helps, certainly helps to have a very sharply defined agenda, which is more about rolling back what's been done in the government than about building. And that's what Republicans have been able to do, because Democrats controlled the country for so long, and so it was easier for Republicans to simply want to dismantle what had been done. But I also think, you know, Lakoff's larger point is relevant here, which is that it's not about this issue, that issue, magic words for on abortion, magic words on guns. It's about a very cohesive metaphor. It's about where, you know, you're on a road, you're taking the country somewhere. Where is it you want to take the country? And I think you can have all the right language on a lot of different positions. What Democrats lack, I really believe and have written many times, is a more overarching structure, a more overarching view or metaphor for where a story about where this country's headed for the next 30, 40, 50 years. It's critical.
Our guest is Matt Bai. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. Matt, you believe that the Democrats ought to have a contentious conversation, I guess debate, about what you just discussed, the future of the party, the future of the country. But yet we see many Democrats talking about the need for a unified front. I mean, how do you do both?
Right. No, I have said this, and Mark, you just put your finger on, I think, what is the central question in my mind, and not many people disagree with me, and many people who probably know more than me, but this is in my mind the central question, and you've just hit on it, is that I think there are two things in opposition here, short-term and long-term. I think unity is absolutely critical in the short-term in pushing back the Bush agenda, and you've seen it employed very effectively by Democrats in Congress over the last 6 months and among a lot of the supportive groups, and certainly they deserve credit for that. But I do think there is a conflicting long-term interest which says if you want to have the kind of agenda that drives a country over a longer period of time, you got to have a fight about which ideas are right, where the country should go. You have to have a real conversation about that, and somebody has to win and somebody has to lose sometimes. Not necessarily left, center, right, whatever you want. It just has to be I think those paradigms are kind of old, but I do think you have to have a genuine, vigorous discussion. Republicans went through that first before they were unified. I think all political parties do. And so it's a conflict, and it's a problem.
But, Matt, when you start talking about that, the implication is that somebody's ox on the Democratic side is going to get gored. Like, maybe people will say, well, we don't need to push the gay marriage issue so much, or maybe we don't need to really focus on extending the Voting Rights Act, whatever. What do you do to keep the groups who might get upset by this kind of thing in the fold?
Yeah, I think that's a false premise, because I don't think this is about gay marriage or this isn't about, you know, civil rights. It's not about social issues. It's not about one interest group. I mean, and Democrats tend to think about everything in terms of interest groups. I don't think this is about any interest groups getting left out of the room. And so this is about a new globalized economy. This is about a country with a completely changed economic base, with a declining living wage for workers. This is about how you adapt to profound, transformative changes in the national economy and in the national security. And these are 50-100-year questions. These are not questions about, you know, who gets the best seat at the convention next year, or which issue you're going to talk about in 2008 or 2012. This is about modernizing your view of the world to match the anxiety that people bring to it.
Okay, Matt Bai, let's talk about something that it has a 30-year window on it. Let's talk about the coming nomination process for this for Roberts.
Right.
Let's talk about how the Supreme Court battle is going to take shape in light of using some of the Democratic frames that you were talking about, because this is a decision that is going to have some impact for a good many years to come.
Yeah, and Democrats have rolled out, you know, what seems to be at this point, I'm no pollster, but seems to be a very effective frame, if you want to call it that, for them. And that is, they've talked about this Republican abuse of power. I mean, you'll hear this term a million times. We've heard it before. I don't know how much they'll use this against Judge Roberts, because I think there's a real question right now in Washington about how vigorously, in fact, they want to go after him in this nominating process. But I do think that the general frame has been effective. It's been tested, and it seemed to work well in the debate over the filibuster, which is that Republicans control everything. They've got Congress, they've got the courts, they've got, you know, all these seats, and yet it's not enough. They won't consult with Democrats. They won't let anyone else at the table. They kind of want to thumb their noses at the process. I think that's been an effective frame, because I think people, even people supportive in a lot of cases of Republicans, generally have a feeling like that's what's going on. And I think, of course, that's when frames and unified messages are particularly effective, when you tap into something that that voters themselves already really have some sense of.
Now, Matt, you're out in Chicago. You're out at the AFL-CIO, am I right?
You are.
Now, there's been a little contentious debate going on there. Apparently, some of the service unions and the Teamsters are boycotting.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that, because it really goes to the heart of what we're talking about. It's actually not a separate issue at all, which is that there are two major unions that are expected to leave the AFL-CIO today, the Teamsters and SEIU. And SEIU, you know, is the largest union in North America. Others will probably follow. Ultimately, you're probably looking at a third of the AFL-CIO membership. What this means, in very practical terms, is there's a lot of technical stuff. What this really means is the end of big labor as we know it from the 20th century. I mean, we're really seeing a very significant split.
Good thing, a bad thing?
Well, I don't know if it's a good thing or bad thing, because there's a lot of different interpretations. But I do think it is part of this debate I'm talking about, and it is part of this. This is precisely related to this idea of globalization and long-term vision, that these are unions looking at the world, and some unions saying, hey, it's not going our way, but we're doing the best we can, and the only chance we have is to stand together, and a bunch of other unions saying, you know what, it's not good enough if we know where this is going to end, and we need a new approach and a new way of thinking about it. We need to try something more dramatic and more different, and if you won't do it, we will. And I think, you know, in some sense, I think that's the debate that Democrats are probably going to have as well, and they're seeing it played out in their largest, most influential interest group, and the group that really built the middle class in this country.
And the union frame is up for grabs, as we're seeing, you know, here in New York with Bloomberg, and the largest union here in New York going behind Bloomberg, is that is not a specifically or reliable Democratic frame anymore.
Absolutely right, and that's why I think this is a metaphor. It does have a direct relation to the party, the larger idea of the party, because these are these folks have lost a lot of their constituency. They've lost union membership. They've lost the loyalties of the union membership they have.
Mm.
And they've not really put forward a compelling vision to say to workers, what's the 21st century going to look like? In fact, you know, someone said to me the other day, and I think it was very smart, we don't even know what workers are. We don't know what the word labor means. These things are not words that even mean a lot to the people today who get up and go to work for
That's
wages
true.
And no benefits. And it's time to, there's almost a need for a new lexicon here, a whole new approach. And I, you know, I make no secret of it. I'm a big proponent for the idea that times, transformative times require transformative ideas.
You hear that, Democrats? That's Matt Bai telling you. Okay.
Sorry, I don't think they care so much.
Well, they better start. Matt Bai, thanks for joining us. It was great talking to you.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, take care. That was Matt Bai, contributing writer for New York Times Magazine. He's got a book coming out about the future of the Democratic Party. That's in 2007. And speaking about workers, unions, we got the job listing coming up. It's 47 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Hi, this is Phil Lesh from the Grateful Dead. One time, I was listening to Morning Sedition and Marin started riffing on the Bush administration. Then Riley came in with a slamming groove about the right wing's use of the media. Just when you thought it couldn't get any freakier, Marin broke into Scarlet Begonias. What a sick jam. Best show ever. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. That, of course, the theme music to 6 Feet Under on HBO. On that show, apparently, last night, though I didn't watch it. I used to watch it, but I didn't watch it last night. Apparently, we were on the radio in Claire's car.
Uh-oh.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I like that. And apparently, we got paid a little money for that. And they bought us some speakers for our remote broadcast.
Is that for the microphone condoms we got? Is that what paid for them?
No, maybe. Maybe. Are these new ones? I don't even know.
I don't know.
If people don't know what microphone condoms are, they're the spongy sort of, what do you call this material? They're the things that make radio
latex.
Mics look big. Foam. Yeah, that's it. Foam, Chris. Thanks. I don't know where that went in my head. Foam. You know, sometimes simple words like dummy, they just go away. They just disappear into the weird. Man, I took melatonin last night to sleep. That amino, whatever the hell it is, that healthy thing. It's not a sleeping pill. It's an herb. And I had some weird ones, man. I had some weird dreams that I didn't even want to go into on the air. Because they were too weird. All right? They were too weird. They involved Jerry Seinfeld and a midget in drag with a very large thing. And I don't know what it means. Yeah, I'm not even going to go into it. I think I went into it enough, you know? If this were another kind of show, I would definitely go into it more. But it's one of those dreams where you're like, hey, this is really cool. There's this thing. And then you realize, like, oh, my God, that was in my head. What does that mean about me? You know what I'm saying, Riley?
I know what you're saying.
Let's do this. We all know a lot of people are out of work. And we want to help you out. And we know you spent your Sunday leafing through the want ads. And we want to be part of the solution. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday Help Wanted listing. Wanted, rodeo clown. The Bush administration is seeking someone who can distract a pack of enraged bull reporters from the somewhat corpulent suit of lights that is the flamboyant matador Karl Rove. You will be responsible for doing something, anything, more appealing to news hounds than the spectacle of the fallen boy wonder with sweat dripping down his hammy cheeks. No Stepford Wife Supreme Court Justice nominees need apply. Sorry, it just didn't work. As an indication of how difficult this job will be, we have previously placed a male prostitute with a penchant for urinating on customers in the White House press corps, and nobody seemed to bat an eye. Please note, this is listed as a temporary position, but if you work out, we can discuss the possibility of full-time employment. We are always looking for someone who can make people forget the sinkhole of debt and death we've created in the Middle East.
Wow.
There you go.
Hey, Matt.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry to bother you, but my friend Chris Rosen, he's the board op for the Al Franken show.
Yeah.
And 6 Feet Under asked for a clip of the Al Franken show for 6 Feet Under for Claire to be driving to. And they chose Morning Sedition over the Al Franken show.
Oh!
I don't understand that. You know, Morning Sedition,
Oh, yeah, that's on in the morning.
Well, it's a good thing he's not in the same studio.
My Franken impression's rusty. I didn't think it was that good to begin with. Yeah. Anyway, we got a call. Doug in Staten Island. Doug, he's got. How are you?
Good morning.
What's up, Doug?
Some pills make you happy, and some pills make you small, and the ones that Carl Rove gives you really make you want to crawl.
Okay. Ooh. All right. What's on your mind about anything?
Well, you know, I'm just... Oh, well, there's so many things. I mean, we... You
Let's
know,
try and focus it, Doug.
Yeah, I am. You know, listen, the whole thing is... You know, I think it was Robert Frost that said, you know, the definition of a liberal is a man too broad-minded to take his own side in a quarrel.
That's pretty good.
You know, and yeah. We have got to focus. We have, I mean, we don't have to just criticize their vernacular, the way they take social and public and liberal and progressive and make them pejoratives. But, I mean, we have to really get on board with our own ideas, our own dissemination of information.
Right, right.
Exactly what they mean.
The frames have got to stick. You're talking in relation to our last guest, Matt Bai, was talking about reframing the issues, and the Democrats need to put a substantial amount of work in unifying the party and making these stories, these narratives about what's important to us work for the public.
Yeah, because, you know, the Republicans are smart. They appeal to this individual, you know, this kind of idea that we all got this way by ourselves. We pulled ourselves up by our own bootstraps. I mean, and people don't realize that, you know, the 40-hour work week, health, holidays, security,
sure.
Everything came from people dying, and they're asking us to relive the Industrial Revolution. And we have the Democrats dipping from the same pot and going, well, I'd like to, but give me a little bit more money and we'll see.
Yeah, that's right. We got to change the language. And it's weird, this whole pulling up by your bootstraps thing. I don't know where that comes from, and it's very hard for people to do if they don't have shoes.
Well, you know, and I'm going to tell you something else.
Thanks for your call, Doug.
The oldest frames in the Democratic Party are the frames used in the black community, and the Democrats are going to get hurt by it unless they learn that.
Are we being watched right now, Riley?
Uh-oh.
Are we being watched? They got a camera in here yet? Man, it's coming down here in New York, surveillance, bag searches. You know, we're going to talk about that when we come back, and we got the movies too. We're going to talk about movies. 57
yeah.
Best of the Hour, Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition
on Air America
Six past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Oh, man. It's Monday. I'm all jacked up. I've got a lot of momentum here, Riley. I don't know what it is.
Well, me too, because I just looked at our rundown, and I realized I was in the wrong hour.
You were in the wrong hour?
So I was still in the 7 o'clock hour. I'm saying, whoa, wait a minute.
You're like on daylight savings time?
Yeah,
you just picked
Central
up,
standard.
You just picked up an hour, Riley?
There you go. Now right. I'm okay.
All right, good, man. Well, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
I didn't realize you lost an hour. I didn't get to lose an hour. Look, you know, Lance Armstrong won the Tour de France for the seventh time, got up there and said, that's it, I'm done. And I did this for my kids, this last one. He said, I just wanted them to see me as a champion.
Yep.
I wanted to go out big, and he did. The guy's an amazing guy. Transcended cancer, transcended divorce, transcended scandals revolving around steroids. It's a solitary sport. It's a cowboy sport, only it's a bike, not a horse or a bull.
And, you know, the interesting thing to me, the guy is only 34 years old.
Yeah.
He's not, I mean, it's not like he was 40 and doing all of this and retiring like Jack Nicklaus or somebody.
I'll tell you, he looks so emaciated. You know, you look so emaciated. When he's in perfect shape, it's like, God, he looks awful. He's in perfect shape. Look,
he's like at 160 pounds, I think.
He's just all leg muscles, and he's all gaunt in his face. But, you know, I don't know much about the sport. I'm trying to figure it out. You know,
it is grueling. All you need to know about it is that it is grueling.
In my head, it's a bike race, you know, but there's all these different levels, there's different stages, there's this, there's that. You know, maybe
21 different stages.
I should get more interested. Why doesn't someone take me to a ball game, damn it? How about you take me to a ball game? Chris, why don't we go to a ball game, will you?
Yeah,
come on.
We're planning it, don't worry.
Can I call you Dad?
He's going Pop.
Chris, well, you're lucky he's going to get hit with a foul ball. You know that, right?
Can I bring my mitt? I want to bring my mitt. All right. Look, folks.
I'll buy you cotton candy.
Oh, yay.
$5 cotton candy.
I'm going to bake some macaroni and cheese, man. I got a recipe, dude. It's going to kill you.
Uh-oh.
I'll bring it on Friday since we're not going to be going out. We'll have pastries and mac and cheese. Look. The heat wave is like, if you don't think there's global warming, let me tell you something. I got to tell you, there is, because I'm looking at these temperatures, man. Las Vegas, Nevada, 117 degrees on Tuesday. Reno, Nevada, 100 degrees for 10 days in a row. Tucson, 100 degrees, 30 days in a row.
39 days in a row, Tucson, Arizona.
I thought it was 30 earlier. God, we went into a time void. You lost an hour. An
hour, yeah.
Tucson lost 9 days. Wow, what's going on?
You know, my father actually lives in Phoenix, Arizona.
He's probably hot.
And no, he loves it, but he wants me to visit. I'm like, I don't know if that's
going to
happen.
Oh, you got to go. My brother lives in Phoenix. I used to go out to Phoenix all the time because I kind of like to eat, and it's dry, too. So what that means is essentially you don't know. It sneaks right up on you. All of a sudden, you're outside, and you're like, I've got no liquid left in my body. My blood has turned thick. I can't breathe. It happens all at once. Here in New York, with the humidity, you feel drenched and sweat all the time. You dehydrate, but not like there. Out there, it's all of a sudden, you literally can watch your hands like a movie, like start to get dry and brittle, and your fingers will break and fall off if you don't hydrate yourself. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit. Look, you know, we were talking a lot about security, about surveillance, yeah. This is an important issue, and this is going to be an issue that's going to be with us for a long time, how to handle that issue. And then we had our guest Matt Bai on earlier to talk about framing and how the Democrats can start to talk about that the issues that are important to us as Democrats and get them out to the country at large and make them resonate with regular people. We got a sort of a surprise call here from a guy who managed to do that. We have Democratic Governor of Virginia Mark Warner on the phone, and he managed as a Democrat to appeal to the Southern rural vote, which is an amazing thing. Governor Warner, so what do you got on your mind? You're down there speaking at a two-day session of the Democratic National Conversation. What is that?
Well, Mark and Mark, it's Mark.
Hey, how are you, buddy?
How you doing, Mark, Governor?
Well, Mark's in the morning here.
Exactly. Three of us.
Well, this is the Democratic Leadership Council's National Conversation, which is really more moderate centrist Democrats coming together. We've got Senator Tom Carper this morning, Tom Vilsack, the governor of Iowa, Senator Evan Bayh, Senator Hillary Clinton's coming in. And it really is, I think, one of the better think tank groups and political organizing group for folks who believe, like me, that if, you know, the Democratic Party continues to go after 16 states and then tries to hit that triple bank shot to get the 17th state, that we're doing the party and the country a disservice. That even if we happen to win the presidency that way, we cede two-thirds of the country to the Republican Party. And that doesn't make sense for our party or our country.
So how do we go after the whole country, Governor, without becoming Republicans?
Well, I think there's an easy way to go after them. Let me tell you why.
Okay.
First of all, for years, the right wing of the Republican Party has been mostly asking their candidates to take these extreme social positions. But for the most part, the candidates take the positions during the campaigns, but pay them only lip service once they get elected.
Right.
I think after 2004, the right wing of the Republican Party woke up and said, well, hold it. We got the Congress. We got the presidency. We got the courts. We got the majority of governors. We want our pound of flesh. So now, whether you see it on the Terry Schiavo case, stem cell, you see it on these new litmus tests coming out of the right wing, you combine that with the horrible fiscal record they've put together and the fact that they have diminished America's status in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that means a whole lot of people in the center. That means a whole lot of folks who are independents, moderate Republicans, are looking for a home. If we can put forward folks who can not forget what we're about as Democrats, but reach out to that sensible center. And I got to tell you, I'm living proof that it works. You can't get any redder state than Virginia. And not only have I been successful in Virginia in getting elected, but we've put through a tax reform plan and a Republican legislature that's 2-1 against me. We've made record new investments in education. Virginia was named the best managed state in the country this year by an independent 2-year survey. So we as Democrats can govern. But we've got to be able to, I think, not only turn out as many folks in the Democratic family as possible, but also go get some of them, because we've got to acknowledge, I think we've got to acknowledge on the front end that right now we're a minority party in this country.
Governor, how do you propose to stop the erosion of young black voters away from the Democratic Party? Some of that erosion certainly made itself manifest in Ohio during last year's election. And it seems as though young black voters in particular are turning away from the civil rights paradigm, which has been so reliable for Democrats in the past. How do you draw a new picture?
Well, one of the ways is you don't walk away from anything related to civil rights, related to social justice. One of the things I've tried to focus on, for example, is the restoration of voting rights, which we have one of the most out-of-the-mainstream policies in the whole country in Virginia. But also, particularly for younger African-American voters, you got to talk about economic empowerment. It can't simply be legal empowerment. It's got to be economic empowerment as well. We've made a major focus of our administration, small women and minority business involvement, engagement, and saying, how do you get your own, your own fair shake, your own shot at, your own personal shot at your own version of the American dream? And, for a lot of young, I was in venture capital before I went into politics. There is enormous hunger in terms of young black entrepreneurs. There's not nearly as easy a path to get there. I was an entrepreneur. I failed three times before I started Nextel. But I had a couple of extra shots. If I had not been a white guy, I'm not sure what I've gotten these extra shots. So I think this whole notion of economic empowerment is one that has a powerful message, and we sometimes as Democrats, I think some traditional Democrats, have been afraid to talk about that because somehow economic success amongst some is not viewed as positive.
Well, how do we handle, our guest is Democratic Governor Mark Warner of Virginia. It seems though a lot of the platforms that you were able to win on, pro-death penalty, pro-gun rights, fiscal conservatism, these are real deal breakers for a lot of liberals and a lot of Democrats. And, I just want to know, specifically, how do we honor some of the more democratic values around reproductive freedom and around, social programs? I mean, how do we honor these and still, stay Democrats?
Let me put it like this. What I said was, we haven't rolled back a single gun law in Virginia. I said we ought to enforce our existing gun laws.
Mm-hmm.
What it did mean, though, that a whole lot of people in rural Virginia, black and white, who had not been voting for a Democrat in a long time, said, hey, I'm going to take a second look at this guy. And that's allowed us to do more in terms of rural economic development, rural job growth, rural education than any governor in Virginia history. When it comes to the death penalty, yes, there's no issue more difficult than that. But I believe in certain cases, with appropriate safeguards, the death penalty is an appropriate sanction. Now, we've also put in place the most extensive DNA review, again, of any state. I think in terms of social programs, I'll give you one that we're working on right now. Medicaid. Medicaid is an issue where the nation's governors, I've been chairman of the National Governors Association, the nation's governors are the only group who put together a bipartisan plan to reform Medicaid. Now, there are some in the party who will say, hold it, we can't touch anything about Medicaid. It frustrates me because two things. One, there seems to be this focus on Medicaid, but a complete forgetting of the 45 million Americans who don't have any health care.
Right.
And the fact that if we don't get our handles around Medicaid, what's happening in Tennessee, what's happening in Missouri, where people are getting actually pushed off the rolls because Medicaid is going to bankrupt every state in the country by 2020 unless we can find a way to stem the flow of folks going on to Medicaid and hopefully end up providing a little bit broader coverage.
All right,
Sometimes
Governor.
I think people in our party get more in love with the program than the goal. The goal here ought to be how we get the best health care for the most number of Americans possible.
Well, that sounds good to me, Governor Mark Warner of Virginia. Let me ask you a quick last question. It sounds like you all are discussing a lot of ideas down there, Hillary Clinton, Tom Vilsack, Evan Bay, and those are a lot of names that we hear that might be running for president in 2008. Is this the platform we can look forward to hearing from you? Are you going to be throwing your hat into the ring there?
Time will tell. I do know this. I want to be part of a debate that ends up getting the Democrats back to being the majority party in this country.
Well, thank you very much for calling us, Governor Mark Warner of Virginia. Appreciate talking to you.
All right, Mark and Mark. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks,
take
Governor.
Care. It's interesting about this whole centrist movement because, obviously, they've got answers for, the criticism that, is it really democratic what we're talking about? And that debate's going to go on. I still think, I don't know if this is a surefire way to get everybody on board.
Well, it's interesting. Some of this is going to have to be filtered through some of the things that Matt Bay was discussing an hour ago.
It's going to be interesting. And I definitely want to to get everybody at least on a similar page.
Yeah.
When we come back, I have a feeling that Pendejo is going to call, and I know some people have a problem with that word, but he is our revolutionary, and we always enjoy hearing from him. It's 18 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
Morning's Edition, on the air and online. Morning'sEdition.com, Air America Radio.
Hey, 22 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Wow. I'll tell you, I just like to say that sometimes because I hear it in my headphones. I sound like a radio guy. Hey! Wow. Hey. I'll tell you, man. Here in New York City, they're searching bags. They're thinking about putting cameras everywhere. And some people, myself included, are kind of like, well, is that bad? I know it's bad. I know it's, you know, it's part of the culture of fear and it'll make us all easily led, but I get a little paranoid. Maybe I'm, you know what? Maybe I've got to clean my brain out, Riley. Maybe I've got to fight the fight and say, do not infringe upon my rights, my friends. I don't care what you think it is. In the long term, this is no good, and it's a tool to keep people oppressed.
Well, see, what you have here, Mark, are a number of conflicting emotions and a number of conflicting precedents in law. And you have the very real question of how long this stepped-up security is going to last. Why? Because it costs the New York City Police Department $2 million a day to be on this kind of high alert sort of thing. So you got to say to yourself, well, how long? Till the end of the year? Till after the election? For a year? Forever? How long do you have people in law enforcement spending their time in trains, searching people's bags, while other squads, perhaps burglary, narcotics, and some of the other squads, are depleted because all this manpower or person power is being shifted?
It's all, you know, it's crazy because you can't have that disbalance to divert all that manpower for something that might happen when you know, and take it away from things that are happening on a day-to-day basis, because then we know what New York will be again. Fun.
Yeah.
So, come on. Remember the 70s, man?
Hey, man, I love the 70s.
I know you did. That's what I'm saying. But the real question is how much do we have to adapt to? You already got people. You got, you know, a squad of police officers armed get on a double-decker tour bus because they were tipped off by a guy that works at the bus company that some guys look suspicious. They take everybody out. They put five guys down on the knees, handcuff them, Asian guys with English accents. Turns out they didn't have nothing. They weren't a threat to anybody, but they did it at the behest, at the request, at the advice of just a guy. You can't have that. Before that, how long will it take? Like, look, we all get used to this stuff, and some people that call and some people that are in the articles are sort of like, well, I guess this is just what we have to deal with because of the way things are. But how long before people are like, you know, I'm not going to go anywhere anymore? Like already, you know, like airports, you got to give yourself an extra hour. If you travel a lot, you know which airports are worse than others. You know which lines to go through. You know how to work around it. People are flying into smaller airports to avoid lines. How long before people just say, you know what, the hell with them? I'm just going to stay home.
Yeah, and that, by the way, would deal the American economy a crippling blow. Save a lot on gas and oil, theoretically, but it would deal the American economy a crippling blow because many places in this country, Mark, New York included, depend on tourism from other Americans. I mean, we get a lot of people from Europe and from all over the world coming here, but the other side of the equation is that we get a lot of people that come from Kansas and Wisconsin and Minnesota. And, you know, those folks, if they decide not to travel, because not because they're afraid of security in New York, but because the whole security thing is just too much of a hassle
for
them.
Yeah, and that's like they're not, it's not because they're afraid of terrorists. They just don't want to be bogged down with the things that terrorists made us do.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have a situation here in New York where, as you point out, yesterday they end up handcuffing five Asian guys and turns out they were tourists. Well, the flip side of that for some New Yorkers is the question of what happens the next time somebody ignores that phone call. And they were five terrorists.
I know. It's such a pain. Let's lighten things up. Guess what's coming to America? Crazy Frog. That's right, folks. The thing that went to the top of the charts in England, the ringtone that beat out Coldplay on the British pop charts is coming to America. So, boy, I'm looking forward to hearing this on the train.
Hey, it's already on the Disney Channel, and I'm afraid it may cause more than a few broken cell phones as parents go at them with hammers to make them shut up.
This is stupid.
Why? Well,
weren't you going to get it, Riley?
I was, but then it was too much of a hassle. You know, it's the work of Satan. Plus, I know I would have gotten bored inside of a matter of minutes.
Yeah. Well, coming up, we've got the comedian Mishna Wolf is going to be in the studio. I know her pretty well. I'm glad she's here.
You know her?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm not going to tell you how. Uh-oh. Did she bring me coffee, maybe?
No.
She did.
With soy
coffee.
Milk?
Yeah, I hope so. So comedian Mishna Wolf, and also we've got David Poland is going to be with us, editor of Movie City News. He's going to be a regular guest here on the show to tell us why Hollywood is full of it. 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning's Edition.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Joining us in the studio, comedian Mishna Wolf. How are you? Nice to see you.
Good to see you too.
It's been quite some time, a couple hours, anyways.
Yes.
She's going to be appearing at Giggles in Seattle on August 5th, headlining. Now on the phone. Also, we're going to bring in another guest. We're going to have a little movie party here. It's Monday, which means every media outlet is going to be trotting out this weekend box office numbers from last weekend. What are some of the myths about the numbers, and what are the facts? Joining us by phone from Los Angeles is editor of MovieCityNews.com and creator of the website's Hot Button column and the Hot Blog, David Poland. Welcome back to the show. Good morning.
Morning, guys. Last time I was in Seattle, nobody had a sense of humor.
Really?
Oh.
When was that?
Oh. For the film festival a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, that'll do it.
Film festivals suck the fun out of everything, don't they?
It was actually a lot of fun, despite the fact that people took everything very, very seriously.
Okay, let me ask you something, David, because I've grown to resent Owen Wilson. I don't like him anymore. I liked him in Bottle Rocket, maybe the first other movie. But now I have spite for him. I think that Vince Vaughn is funny, but I have spite for them. I don't want to see the posters anymore. Did the movie suck?
No, the movie doesn't suck. It's actually fun. It's a little bit overrated, but it's a fun movie.
The Wedding Crashers is a fun movie.
The Wedding Crashers, yes. The real movie, though, to watch out for, the R-rated comedy of the summer, is really The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which is coming out in a few weeks.
That's gonna really? How can that be good? That's going to be good.
It's so incredibly funny for a movie that's so incredibly stupid. You just can't believe that you're sitting there laughing your butt off through the entire picture. But that's really the funniest of the R-rated comedies coming out. But, Wedding Crashers is not unpleasant.
But let me ask you something, David. When did it become... Are we making too many exceptions these days? I mean, do we just make exceptions? Is it enough for a movie just to be okay and have one funny part?
Unfortunately, yes. Ultimately, audiences... If you give audiences 4 or 5 moments in a film, doesn't matter whether it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't matter. I mean, Fantastic Four is the perfect example. People don't hate that movie nearly enough. They should despise it. People should be out actually trying to burn the copies of the print.
you're breaking Mishna's heart here. She loves those kind of movies.
I really do.
What's bad about that one?
It's just unwatchable pap. I mean, it's just completely, it has no spirit, it has no characterization, nobody can act, but it has really big special effects, so therefore it's okay.
Oh, yeah, it is.
But now, David, is it a bad sign that this week the top two movies are the same top two movies as they were last week?
It's a bad sign for DreamWorks.
Oh, yeah.
It's a bad sign for Michael Bay, who ominously said in a story last week, I've never had a bomb.
Oh.
Yeah, but can I just interject something right now? It's like, I think people have... pretty low expectations of a lot of films, and if they're not disappointed, they're really happy. And every Michael Bay film I've ever seen, I felt tricked when I left the theater. I literally felt like I had to see it because it was the summer blockbuster and it had been hyped for months and we were all waiting to see it, and then I left the theater and I literally felt like someone had deceived me.
Well, this weekend you had a choice between being tricked and whoop that trick in Hustle and Flow. But no, the funny thing is I think this is one of Michael Bay's better movies. Ironically, there is enough in this picture as a movie, but the thing is, I've always said this, opening weekend is never about the movie, ever, 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 ever. It's always about the marketing. So that's what the whole business has become about, marketing that first weekend, and whether or not you get what you want is really kind of a separate issue.
Well, he did bring us the bomb's point of view in Pearl Harbor. Well, now we're going to see him from the point of view of a bomb. And if this thing, yeah,
I love the children playing in the field at 3 o'clock in the morning, waiting for the bombs to come hit them.
Sure, sure. Hey, who cares about history?
Ben Affleck's actually, the great story in that movie was that he started to shoot Ben Affleck, and he said, I can't shoot you. What do you mean? Because your teeth are horrible. And he had $20,000 in dentistry within 5 days.
No kidding.
Wow. Yeah.
Too ugly. Ben Affleck was too ugly.
Ben Affleck was sixth for Michael Bay.
Okay, well, there you go. So special effects wizard, they brought him into what?
Unfortunately not sixth well enough for Jennifer Garner.
You brought up another thing, which is, I have a question, which is about stars.
Sure.
You know, they always seem to think that having a really big star in a movie makes people go see it. And I don't know about the general watching audience, and maybe you can clear this up, but there are very few people I will go to a movie to see, but there are a lot of people I will not go see a movie because they're in.
You're no longer the general audience, then, apparently.
Oh, really?
I would say that, I mean, ultimately every element of the movies, whether it's making a remake or whether it's doing a book that's popular or whether it's a movie star, they're all elements of selling that first weekend gross.
Oh.
So the whole idea of a movie star, usually there's a correlation between how much a movie star gets paid when you hear about $10 million, $20 million. There's a correlation between what they draw on opening weekend or what the perceived draw is on opening weekend and how much they get paid. Because that's really what they're there for. It's not because they're the best actor. It's not because there are a few that are at the very highest level who make very good choices. So somebody like Will Smith or somebody like Tom Hanks in his day, because he's kind of slipped a little bit, Tom Cruise, they've made choices of movies that are very commercial, so there's that element also. But generally, they're just a piece of the marketing campaign. They're will, you know, if you're sick of seeing Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn on posters everywhere, they're doing their job.
Well, it's just that there was one in my shower, and I thought that was inappropriate and wrong.
Well, the problem is all the plastic surgeons out here are now doing the Owen Wilson nose.
Oh, my God.
No.
What do you mean? They're just bringing people in and smacking them? they're just kind of like just punching them right in the face?
Yeah,
oh, there you go.
You can only get at certain hotels.
Right. Here, let me prepare you for your audition. There you go. You look just like Owen Wilson. Hey, so, dude, I'm reading this article on the new Mel Gibson movie. It's going to be in some sort of Mayan dialect.
Yeah.
That's genius, man.
Is that the Passion 2 Electric Boogaloo?
Yeah. No, I mean, who's he trying to appeal to with this one? I know there's a story out now that that Christians are the niche market in Hollywood. Is this this Aztec film? Or I'm sorry, I don't want to confuse Mayan and Aztec, but apparently, who's he looking to appeal to here?
Super conservative Mayans are very There's going to be starting Air Mayan. It's going to be starting soon.
Good.
So is this going to be a Christian movie though?
No Christ in this movie.
Oh,
no Christ.
I guess you
can't.
Else.
I guess you can't really do a sequel of that one.
Well, you could actually. Well, you couldn't do a sequel, but you could do a prequel.
Oh, good one.
Yes.
Now, David,
we see box office receipts, according to today's papers, are down from the same period last year. Now, when we had John before, you kind of debunked the whole notion that this means that the movie business is in the crapper. What is this? What does this box office receipts down actually mean?
What it actually means is that the island underperformed a lot. That really is the biggest thing. If you look, you know, basically what happens during the summer is every weekend there's a big movie. And this the big movie this weekend did $12 million. So as you said before, there's, you know, when you see the number one and two movies being the same, that is a bad sign because theoretically a movie like The Island should have done at least $30 million opening weekend, and that's pretty much all it means. I mean, and it is a difference of $20 million. It's not really like it's a huge deficit that couldn't be made up.
Maybe people just sat at home and watched Logan's Run, The Matrix, and Blade Runner and got the same vibe.
You know, my personal take is that you didn't have any idea what really happens in the movie from the commercials, even though, you know, irritating Michael Bay, whatever. In the meantime, people like to have a story.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not able to say, this is a movie about X, It's very hard to get your girlfriend to go to the movies.
What about the go ahead, Wolf.
Wait, no, I just have Cinderella Man this summer.
I think they were pretty much selling the same movie they had last summer,
mm-hmm.
which was Seabiscuit, which nobody really wanted to see, you know, Russell Crowe with a
habit
in his mouth.
As a horse.
Yeah. I mean, I call it Fist Biscuits in the beginning, and they pretty much sold it like that. The movie was pretty much that. And I think people liked the movie last year but didn't really need to see it again this year.
Okay, let's talk about Christian marketing. Is this a real trend? Are they being that specific, or was the... It seems to me that certainly with Mel Gibson's company, I mean, let's be honest. This guy made, what, almost $1 billion on the back of Jesus. And clearly it's not about Jesus for him, I don't think. It's a business venture. But are they, because of the passion, have they figured out a way to market specifically to Christians?
Oh, I think he legitimately is crazy for Christ.
Yeah, I think
really,
so.
I mean, he has his own church out here. He's built his own church.
He does?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's pretty serious about it. I wouldn't demean that. But he's pretty serious. But the thing is, they're a niche market like anything else in the niche market, the same way they went to Comic-Con last week to market to geeks.
Mm-hmm.
They're marketing to Christians. So if there's an opportunity, like something like Chronicles of Narnia, they hired the same exact guy, actually, who worked with Mel Gibson on The Passion, who was a guy who had a bunch of websites, the Christian, you know, evangelist guy who had a bunch of websites, who worked with Gibson from the beginning and really fronted The Passion. He was working on Narnia while they were in production. So that is going on, but it's a very niche market. I don't think there's anybody out here really, nobody's made a movie. There's been not a single green light of a movie that is a Christian movie that they're going to try to sell to this large number of people again.
Mm-hmm. Now, David, you talked earlier about some of the hype around the island. In fact, it didn't perform up to expectations. What about Hustle and Flow?
Well, Hustle and Flow is just about where it belonged. It didn't jump up beyond it. It didn't really fall back. $8 million is just about right. It's only on 1,000 screens, so it wasn't really competing with the other movies. So we'll see what it does in the second weekend. One of the problems they had in that picture was theaters like the AMC on 42nd Street in your town in New York wouldn't play it at midnight because of, quote-unquote, security issues.
Mm. Oh, what, do they think everybody's going to walk out and try and be a pimp?
Apparently, right after they saw Wedding Crashers, the people went to Wedding Crashers, were going to hotels and breaking into rooms, but Hustle and Flow people couldn't see the movie.
Get their hair conked and they're going to end up putting tricks out in the street.
Well, there are no black people in 42nd Street in New York. So,
yeah.
So, David, what's your, anything we should see? Anything I should go to this weekend?
This weekend is, Must Love Dogs, which I'm sure is very high on your list of things to do.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God, totally.
If you can avoid stealth, please do that.
What about the Penguin movie?
March of the Penguins, there are people who really love it and there are people who really, really hate it.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of depends. If you saw Winged Migration, that's usually a good sign one way or the other.
Oh, I didn't realize it was a sequel.
It's not actually a literal sequel, but it's a similar sequel.
Okay, I dig.
Cute animals waddling around and killing each other.
And the Virgin movie opens this weekend?
No, the Virgin movie's in a couple weeks. There are actually some really good art films that are coming out in the next few weeks. Not this weekend so much, but The Aristocrats is coming out this weekend, which
I know.
Yeah, I saw it.
I thought it was a lot of fun.
Hey, yeah, can I ask you a question?
No questions.
Okay, a movie like that, what if it was going to be in the theater, could they rate that?
No, it's going out unrated.
Okay.
It would be rated an NC-17, which would limit it, so they just don't have it rated.
Wow.
And because they're not a studio, only the major studios are required to have their movies rated, which is why when Miramax had a movie that would be an NC-17, essentially, they would sometimes sell it to another company because they wouldn't want to release an NC-17.
All right, David, we got to go. Real quick, yes or no, Gus Van Sant's Nirvana movie, good?
I dug it. Some people despise it.
Okay, I'm going to go see that.
I think it's worth it.
Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you next week, right?
Thanks, David.
Absolutely. Have a good one, guys.
Okay, take care. So I think we got Pendejo is going to be calling us on the phone. We got Mishna Wolf here. That was David Poland. If you want to go to moviecitynews.com to see his work, you should. He's a good movie writer. And we're gonna take that call when we come back. It's 47 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
No, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
51 past the hour. Let's land this thing. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Welcome, WSMB, in 1350 AM in New Orleans, Louisiana. Mishna Wolf is here. She will be performing at Giggles on August 5th. That's going to be fun, right, Mish?
Oh, totally.
There you go.
Hey, man. Yeah.
What's up, buddy?
Pendejo, the revolutionary.
It's about time.
He's on line one.
All right, put him through. Hey, Pendejo, how's the...
The revolution is not good, Mark. Not good at all.
What's going on, man? What's wrong? Weren't you interviewing like five hot revolutionary girlfriends you met on the internet dating site?
Yes, I met someone, Mark. In fact, right now I'm in a single-room occupancy hotel in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, no.
I'm shacked up, Mark. Shacked up with an anti-taxation road mama. A biker, Mark, among other things. The revolution is over. I can't escape her gaze.
You're in love.
No, I literally cannot escape her gaze. She's watching the hotel room door from the parking lot while she earns our Eaton money cavorting in the cabs of tractor trailers.
Whoa.
I can't escape.
Isn't there a back window you can sneak out of? I mean, get out of there, man. Run to a payphone. Call a taxi to the Greyhound station. Just leave. You can still save yourself and the revolution.
Did I mention I'm shackled to the television?
Oh.
Black and white television?
Look, man, how did this happen?
It's my fault. I let it happen. She picked me up for our first date, started bitching about the estate tax, and 14 hours later we were in Cleveland. It's all a blur. She got me drunk on Alizé.
Oh, no.
She bamboozled me to a game of truth or dare and kept daring me. Then she turned on Babylon 5 and tricked me into giving me her woman flower.
Oh, she gave you her virginity?
Mark, she's 49 and drives a motorcycle with a sidecar. I hardly think Winona is a virgin. But
what?
But oh, no. I was!
Oh!
And now for the last 3 days, I've just been sitting here waiting for her break from the truckers so we can do the dirty deed, as she calls it. All nice-like, as she says.
Oh, nice.
Oh, I'm afraid Pendejo the revolutionary is dead.
But Pendejo, what about the ultra-liberal revolutionary that I know and love, who wants to stick it to the neocons, who wants to fight the good fight no matter what?
I don't care about the revolution anymore. I've lost my innocence. I'm filthy.
Oh, you don't care about the revolution? Let me ask you something. Can you look Stompers in the eyes and tell him that? Stompers?
I gave Stompers a rucksack of wiener treats and set him loose in Central Park to find his destiny. I let him go.
What are you talking about, you let him go? You went with...
My Shih Tzu.
Who cannot be left alone? Man, you can't just send a Shih Tzu out on a vision quest by itself in New York City.
Stompers doesn't need me. The revolution doesn't need me. I'm dirty, Mark. I'm soiled. I'm worthless. I'm being led around like some prancing satyr with a string around his boy business. I'm lady whipped, Mark. I can lift that TV off me and run if I wanted to. It's a 12-inch. Oh, no. You're right. Stompers, good Lord, Mark. He's all alone.
Oh, no.
My little depressed, sometimes seizing, but always medicated little furry friend is probably being molested this very second by unleashed pugs.
Oh.
I must return and rescue Stompers.
Yes! Yes, get out of there!
I will, Mark. I will tell Winona that my own revolution called.
Yes!
Yes!
I will tell Winona. I will tell Winona.
What? What?
I will tell Winona that I just want to be friends.
Oh. Just to let you know, that whole wannabe friends thing never really goes over that well.
Winona, here she comes. Winona, I've been thinking. I really like you, but I think we should just be friends.
Why, you little! I'm gonna tear you apart! You no good son of a bitch! I almost hate you! Now bet your mama can take you back!
Please, mama. Daddy hurt!
Oh, wow. This sounds like you got your hands full there. Look, buddy, I'm gonna look for Stompers. Just get out of there, man.
Viva la revolution, Mark!
Shut up! Shut up, you idiot!
I'm sorry, miss.
Shut up!
I'm sorry, miss.
Oh, yeah, okay, all right. Bye! Bye! Wow.
Ooh.
That was
spine tingling.
A little rough and uncomfortable there. So, look, do you want to do? All right, we'll do it. That's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for the week.
One, before tomorrow's launch, flood NASA with emails demanding they build a hybrid shuttle. Two, criticize Lance Armstrong's acceptance speech after winning the Tour de France for not blasting Karl Rove even once. I mean, where's that guy stand, huh? Three, protest plans to expand daylight savings time as discriminatory towards vampire Americans. Okay. Four, alert Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee that John Roberts' horoscope, as well as several throws of the I Ching, are all decidedly negative. If bad vibes aren't grounds for the filibuster, what is? Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Checking your backpack is just the beginning, man. Then it's your car, your desk at work, it's your apartment, your house. Then you're in a camp with a tattoo on your wrist, choosing which child you want to keep. Wake up, sheeple. The so-called war against terror is a chance to wipe out the real problem. Your civil rights.
Ooh.
Mishnah Wolf, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Always nice seeing you. August 5th, Giggles Comedy Club, Seattle, Washington. Riley,
yo.
Nice to see you, my
Good
friend.
Good to see you, my friend.
Tomorrow, Rod Nordland is actually going to be here with us.
Oh, okay.
The former Baghdad bureau chief for Newsweek is going to come and tell us about his tales from Iraq and what's going on there. Great show, Riley.
Great show. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition
on Air America Radio.